Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Monday, March 19th, marked the 9th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The anniversary was marked by at least 16 near-simultaneous explosions in cities across Iraq. At least 45 people were killed and 200 were wounded. Here in the States, with very few exceptions, the anniversary was barely mentioned by most media outlets. The Associated Press's Nabil Al-Jirani, reporting from Basra, wrote about Iraqis demanding better services, living conditions, jobs, and an end to corruption on the anniversary. President Obama marked the anniversary by declaring March 19th a, quote, National Day of Honor. He asked Americans to thank the soldiers who served. The U.S. officially marked the end of the occupation in late December. According to Al Jazeera, at the peak of the occupation, the U.S. had more than 500 bases and 165,000 troops in Iraq. Today, according to Pentagon numbers, several hundred military trainers remain on 10 bases. Approximately 15,000 private contractors will remain, working primarily for the State Department, and they're projected to remain in Iraq until September. Joining us to talk about coverage is Jane Araf. She is the Middle East correspondent with Al Jazeera based in Baghdad. Hi, Jane. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks very much.
It's great to have you. So I understand that you're stuck on the road right now and the city of Baghdad is shut down?
Pretty much. It's all the roads are closing, and they're closing because, as you probably know, they're expecting a bunch of Arab heads of state to fly in here for the Arab League summit. Now, that's a huge deal because it hasn't happened here in 20 years, and they had to cancel it last year because of the danger. Now, to avoid car bombs and suicide attacks, they basically shut down pretty much all the major roads, so it is taking hours to get anywhere, and every single vehicle is being checked. They're really very, very cautious and very worried about the kind of explosions that you mentioned just a few days ago.
And what are they planning to discuss at the Arab League summit?
Well, with all of these summits, the main thing really is that it actually takes place at all, and particularly so in Iraq. When you think of it, 9 years after the start of the war, Iraq is really just starting to find its place again in the Arab world. Now, among the dynamics here, the extremely complicated dynamics are, this is a country with a Shia-led government surrounded by Sunni Arab states. There has been unhappiness about that because they see this government, rightly or wrongly, as aligned with Iran. And, of course, that's a whole other dynamic. There's also been violence here that has prevented Arab leaders from coming. And there's been the American occupation. For all of those years that American forces were here, there were some Arab countries that would not open embassies, that would not restore full diplomatic relations because they felt Iraq was under occupation. So the fact that they're coming is kind of a big deal. What they're going to discuss, they're going to discuss Syria. Syria is not invited to the talks. It was suspended from Arab League meetings last year, but they will be discussing what to do about Syria as well as other issues.
And I want to let listeners know Jane Araf will be joining us from Baghdad until about 25 after, and hopefully we'll have a good line until then. And if you'd like to, if you have a question for Jane, or if you saw coverage of the 9th anniversary, we'd love to hear from you. We barely saw anything this week. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment, yourcallradio.org. So, Jane, before we get into specifics about what's really happening in terms of different factions, the relationship between the U.S. and Iraq, what role Iran plays here, we're not getting much coverage out of Iraq. What is daily life like in terms of the basics, like electricity and water? What does that look like?
Well, some of it is quite different from what it was a few years ago, and some really hasn't changed. And the things that haven't changed is there isn't a lot more electricity than there was. People in Baghdad and in other cities routinely go for hours without electricity. Here in Baghdad, parts of the city, electricity comes on for perhaps 6 to 8 hours a day, but in spurts. So you'll have an hour on, at unpredictable intervals and then an hour off. It makes it very difficult to do anything. It makes it difficult to run businesses. Makes it difficult to actually even raise a family, particularly in the summer when the temperatures are more than 120 degrees. Now, the way people compensate is through generators, but you have to have a certain amount of money to afford a generator and afford fuel that goes into it. It's really one of the biggest, what people consider one of the biggest tragedies here, and one of the most baffling questions to many Iraqis as to how it is that this many years after Saddam Hussein was toppled and all the billions of dollars spent, they still can't get electricity out. Water, a lot of people still don't have access to clean water. Mm-hmm. There are things that are improving, certainly from the absolute lows of 2005, 2006, 2007, when this country was racked by civil war and there were bodies in the streets. It's a lot safer, so people are going out a lot, but it's not entirely safe. There's still assassinations, there are mortars, rockets, suicide car bombs. It's still a daily threat in many places. Mm. Basically, Iraqis have learned to live with a strange kind of normalcy.
What explains the lack of services?
That is such a great question. And there isn't really one single answer, but if I were to try to attempt to answer that, the main reasons really are the infrastructure was in very bad shape after more than a decade of crippling sanctions on this country. When the Americans came in, they underestimated what it would take to get things back up and running. The money they poured into this poured right out through corruption in a lot of places, mismanagement. This was a government, this was a country in which most institutions were destroyed. Its ministries were left without competent technocrats who could figure out how to build things, how to spend the money, how to get it out there. It really has, in many senses, for many years, been paralyzed, in a sense, by the fact that a lot of parts of the government are dysfunctional. Mm. So for all of those reasons and more, essential services still aren't nearly where they should be.
And what about what Iraq actually looks like, especially Baghdad? Because over the years, we've seen photos of Baghdad divided by columns of concrete walls separating neighborhoods along ethno-religious lines. And Catriona Davies of CNN just wrote a piece called "Can Baghdad Be Beautiful Again?" And in it, she quotes a French architect saying, quote, "Because of the sectarian violence, a decision was taken to divide the city into separate zones. It's frozen the conflict, but has not brought any fundamental solutions." So what is it like when you're driving down the roads? Are you still seeing these concrete walls?
Yeah, you're still seeing a lot of concrete walls, but not as many as you were seeing. It wasn't a conscious decision so much to divide the neighborhoods. It was much worse than that. In fact, a lot of people were driven out. In mixed neighborhoods, Sunnis were driven out where there were Shia death squads and Shia neighborhoods, Shias, and vice versa, essentially. People fleeing either the Shia death squads or Al-Qaeda and other Sunni extremists. So really what's been left is really a collapse of the wonderful diversity that was Baghdad and that was Iraq. You don't find a lot of neighborhoods anymore that are mixed Sunni, Shia, Christian. A lot of the Christians have left. A lot of the other minorities have been under threat, and they've left as well. Having said that, I and most people who live in Baghdad think it's still beautiful. It has amazing, amazing public art. And one of the things that they have tried to do ahead of the Arab League summit is put up more public sculptures. It's one of the very few cities in the Middle East where you have figurative public art, and art here is very important. On those horrible, ugly glass walls in a lot of places, they've painted them. There are trees coming up. There are businesses opening up. Wow. So it is a broken city, and it's broken in ways that as the whole country is. It's really hard to grasp from a distance. But despite that, it does have a vibrancy and a life to it that persists even after everything it's been through.
I mentioned that the AP reported from Basra about Iraqis demanding better services and an end to corruption. How are Iraqis, how are they reflecting on the 9th anniversary of the U.S. invasion? Are they talking about it? Is this getting much attention in the Iraqi press?
It's an interesting point because it's not really, it gets attention from editorial writers and it gets attention from political parties making political points. It's certainly got attention from Sutterist followers of Shia cleric Murtada Sadr, who staged that protest in Basra. But for the most part, you know, it's funny, isn't it? Because the war has changed almost everything about Iraq, but on a day-to-day basis, people don't really look back at that. So much has happened since, much of it bad, not all of it, but so much has happened that Iraqis generally try to get on with their lives, and they have not dwelled on it. They didn't dwell on it on that anniversary.
And what about the Foreign Press Corps in Iraq? In December, we spoke with The Guardian's Martin Chuloff, who said the foreign press is going to have a minimal presence in Iraq after the U.S. pulls out. So you're there for Al Jazeera. How many other foreign journalists are on the ground in Baghdad?
There aren't too many. I'm here for Al Jazeera English and the Christian Science Monitor, which has had a presence here for years. Those who are left really are, there aren't a lot who have stayed. I've covered this country since 1991, and I was based here when Saddam Hussein was here. And I've got a real attachment to the country. A lot of the people who are here came later. But a lot of the people who covered the war, the beginning of the war, come back and forth. So that's for people actually based here. As you know, there's a lot going on in the Arab world, the Arab Spring, the revolutions, different stories, decreasing budgets among news organizations, and as you pointed out, decreasing interest in the United States. That's certainly a part of it. So it is a very small press corps here. Permanent foreign press, there are probably less than a dozen. But increasingly what we're seeing are Iraqi journalists who are stepping up and covering their own country, which is the natural evolution of things. And increasingly as well, this is becoming a business story. When people get tired of reading about the politics of all of this, there is the enduring lure of the immense amounts of money, and particularly oil money, that are coming through here. And that's where some of the journalism is heading.
And what is the state of the press in Iraq?
Vibrant and chaotic, I would say. Not exactly the sort of press we're used to in the West. They're under a lot of pressure, a lot of restrictions, under threats of arrest many times. There was a very prominent radio talk show host who was shot dead in his home just before a protest a few months ago. And a lot of the news organizations are either tied to political parties or tied to financial interests. So in that sense, there's still a lot of work to be done, as there is in most countries in the Middle East, but it is increasingly a place where Iraqi journalists are actually telling their own story and not waiting for foreigners to tell it.
According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, 151 journalists have been killed in Iraq since 1992. And I'm wondering, Jane, because the ninth anniversary got so little attention in Iraq, since you've been there for so long, what article would you write? You know, if the New York Times came to you and said, all right, we want you to write our anniversary story, what would you focus on?
I think I would focus on essentially what you try to do in any story, whether it's television or radio or newspapers, is bring these complex dynamics in the big picture to life through the eyes of somebody that viewers and readers and listeners can relate to. And what I would probably do is go back to one of the families who I've known since before the war and try to explain to people how life has changed for them. And typically, so many of the families here have lost someone. Either they've had someone killed, or someone has disappeared, or they've had some other catastrophic event happen to them or happen to a close relative. And really, I think what keeps a lot of us here is that it is a country that has been through immense tragedy for decades, really. But despite that, there is an incredible resilience here. And people, I'm amazed sometimes, and was particularly amazed during those bad times when people would see their sons, their daughters, their husbands and wives off to work, and they wouldn't know whether they'd come back in the evening. Life was that precarious. But there is still really a vibrancy here, and this is a country that's reinventing itself, not in wonderful ways, But really, there's a lot going on here. I think one of the things is, too, there's a huge divide now between the Green Zone, which is where the Iraqi government essentially lives, and where the U.S. embassy is and some of the other embassies, and the rest of Baghdad. Increasingly, what happens in there, behind those concrete walls, doesn't matter so much to what happens out here. It's almost becoming two different countries.
And I'm glad you brought this up, the Green Zone. What is the American role at this point? The U.S. embassy, again, is the size of the Vatican. It's huge. So what really goes on there on a regular basis?
That's a great question. It is huge. Not as huge as it was envisioned. Just a few months ago, U.S. diplomats were talking about having an embassy that was the biggest in the world. And as one of the ambassadors, to his misfortune, happened to mention in public at a press briefing, they were to have 16,000 people. Now, that's not just diplomats. It's support staff, and it's support staff as well in all the diplomatic missions in Iraq. Still, those are huge, huge numbers.
Right.
Because of the backlash, because of the political situation, both in Iraq and the U.S., that's been cut down considerably, and they've cut down a lot of those programs. So essentially what the embassy is doing is it's running programs under a wide array of things, education, culture, military cooperation. It's been selling a lot of arms to Iraq as well, so it has personnel to support those. What many Iraqis would say it isn't doing is one of the things they think it should be doing, which is speaking up more publicly and having more influence on the human rights situation here. And that is really one of the black marks on Iraq these days.
We're speaking with Jane Aroff, Middle East correspondent with Al Jazeera English, based in Baghdad. She also writes for the Christian Science Monitor. And we're talking with Jane about Monday's 9th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, March 19th. Didn't really get much attention. The only pieces we saw were in the AP. They were covered by newspapers. But if you saw something and you'd like to bring it to our attention, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. I also saw a piece in People's World about soldiers and families marking the 9th anniversary at the Civic Center Plaza in San Francisco. They put thousands of shoes on the ground to mark the 4,486 soldiers who died. A number of Iraq veterans against the war were there. And you can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. According to the National Priorities Project, taxpayers have spent $802 billion on the invasion and occupation of Iraq. According to Just Foreign Policy, over 1.4 million Iraqis have died. And according to the Iraq Coalition casualty count, 4,486 soldiers have died. And let's hear from Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger.
Yes, thank you, Rose. According to a recent speech by Rand Paul, he said that we spent on the Iraq and Afghan wars $4 trillion. Now, I believe he's correct. The point I want to make is the American people have to be careful how we get involved in those conflicts. We simply can't impose our system on other people who are simply not desirous of it. $4 trillion would have fixed every road and bridge in this country. It would have installed high-speed rail throughout the country. Our country would have profited so much from the money we wasted on this war, and it was a total waste. We essentially spent $4 trillion to eradicate one man, a 65-year-old man who would have been in bad health. So it just, it's ridiculous for this country to keep on getting involved.
Well, thank you for calling, Roger. And that number does come from the economist Joseph Stiglitz. He says when all is said and done, if there ever is a done, when you factor in health care for veterans, it will reach about $3 to $4 trillion. So thank you for calling in. And let's hear from Michael in San Francisco. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for this program, though. I just tuned in. I do want to piggyback on what this previous caller just said. The amount of money spent, and where is any conservative or is any fiscal conservative saying, my goodness, this is so out of bounds as to be an aberration, mm-hmm. as to be totally silly. But the thing I'm calling in for is two things. One is America is never going to get out of Iraq. We're always going to leave mercenaries there, if not troops ready to come in at the moment's notice. so this whole shell game that any president plays, oh, we're taking these out, and by 14, it'll be 16, then it'll be 18, unless the American people get on their representatives, get out in the streets. We're never going to get out. I have a question for the person that you have, I think the English editor of Al Jazeera.
Jane.
Who is the owner, please, of Al Jazeera? Who is the money behind Al Jazeera?
All right, thanks for calling in, Michael. Were you able to hear Michael, Jane?
No, I'm sorry. The security people are telling us that we have to move along. What was the question?
Oh, okay. Michael wanted to find out who's funding Al Jazeera, who owns Al Jazeera English.
Okay. The Emir of Qatar provides most of the funding.
The Qatari government?
That's quite well known.
Right. All right. Well, thank you.
Emir.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
Yeah.
We'll put some more information on the website if you want to read more about that. Jane, also, we had Michael and Roger were calling in about just the sheer amount of money that has been spent, about $802 billion a year or $802 billion on the invasion. But when you factor everything in, it might reach about $3 to $4 trillion. What can you tell us about corruption? I mean, we've done so many shows about corruption. Even members of the State Department have stepped forward to say there was massive corruption.
There is massive corruption. It's absolutely scandalous, and the Iraqis recognize that. They are making some attempts. The Iraqi government is making some attempts to crack down on it, but it's endemic. It's throughout the system, and it goes all the way from traffic police who will ask for bribes in the streets to people getting out of jail or not getting out of jail. In some of the worst cases, people who are decreed they can go free, that they've been cleared of all charges, are not allowed to go free and kept in jail until they pay bribes. And then, of course, there are these huge, huge, huge amounts of money that are siphoned off in corruption for some of the big contracts. It's not a pretty picture, and it really does extend throughout everything. It's probably even more of a threat to Iraq than the security situation, and it's much harder to resolve. It's something that everybody recognizes is one of the very big dangers here.
And we have a book recommendation from Monica, Night Draws Near, Iraq's People and the Shadow of America's War, by the late Anthony Shadid. Thank you for that, Monica. And speaking of the people of Iraq, I just wanted to mention Basma Al-Khatib, an incredible women's rights activist, has been on our show so many times over the years, and I always catch up with her on Facebook. And she says things are becoming much more conservative. At the College of Arts, Basra University, there are signs that say no skirts, no trousers, no boots, no sandals, no short sleeves. And she added, no breathing, no living. She's really fed up with this move to... can you just quickly talk about that? We have just about 30 seconds left, but she says there's a huge shift, and especially going after women.
That's a great point. I first did want to encourage everyone to read Anthony's book, which was absolutely amazing and perhaps one of the only books that captured what it's like for Iraqis here. It is becoming more conservative. There were recent recommendations that women in government ministries in Baghdad should not wear colors. Mm. They couldn't wear high heels, they couldn't wear skirts, they couldn't even wear colors. It's becoming conservative in every way, and that is one of the things that people feel has been lost here, the diversity, the secular nature of many parts of the city that's very much been fragmented.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for your reporting, and we'd love to have you back to check in to find out the latest and maybe find out what happened at this Arab League summit.
Thank you, Rose. I'd love to, and thanks for your callers.
Thank you. That's Jane Aarof, Middle East correspondent with Al Jazeera based in Baghdad. She was talking to us stuck on the road because the city is shut down for this upcoming Arab League summit. When we come back, we'll talk about media coverage of This American Life's retraction of their Mike Daisy monologue. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. We have a free email newsletter. Join more than 7,000 of your fellow listeners who get an email every week or two. It will keep you aware of the diverse programming on local public radio, as well as opportunities to participate in station events. Just click the email newsletter link on the front page of KALW.org, and thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. On Monday, we'll have a conversation about the Oscar-winning Iranian film A Separation. During his acceptance speech, the film's director, Asghar Farhadi, urged the world to understand Iran through its rich cultural heritage and history, when all we hear is talk about war. So how can arts and culture bring Americans and Iranians closer together? And then we're also putting shows together about how farm workers are organizing. We'll be marking Cesar Chavez's birthday next week, and we're doing shows about foreclosures, and we'll have a debate about President Obama's record thus far. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we're going to switch gears here and talk about the This American Life retraction of the very popular Mike Daisy monologue. Back in January, you probably heard this, This American Life ran a piece about Foxconn. That's the factory in Shenzhen, where Apple's iPads and iPhones are manufactured, along with pretty much every other technology company you can name. The story was focused on Mike Daisy's monologue about the workers that he said he met. It was This American Life's most popular podcast. Mike Daisy went on to do interviews with international press and almost every media outlet in the United States. We had him on February 14th, along with Fan Yang, Program Assistance Director at China Labor Watch. Now, when the piece originally aired on This American Life, Ira Glass said, quote, "When I saw Mike Daisy perform this story on stage, when I left the theater, I had a lot of questions. I mean, he's not a reporter. And I wondered, did he get it right? And so we've actually spent a few weeks checking everything that he says in his show." Apple and Foxconn refused This American Life's interview request at that time. Well, last weekend, This American Life dedicated an entire episode to retracting their Mike Daisy show. When Marketplace's Rob Schmitz heard the original piece, he knew there were holes. Certain details just didn't sound right. So he tracked down Daisy's Chinese translator. Rob Schmitz is based in Shanghai. Now, she told him that Mike Daisy did not meet workers who were poisoned with hexane, and we'll hear a clip in just a couple minutes. He also did not meet workers who were 12 years of age. In the Marketplace piece, Rob Schmitz writes, quote, "What makes this a little complicated is that the things Daisy lied about seeing are things that have actually happened in China. Workers making Apple products have been poisoned by hexane. Apple's own audits show the company has caught underage workers at a handful of its suppliers. These things are rare, but together, they form an easy-to-understand narrative about Apple." So joining us to talk about coverage is Rebecca Greenfield. She's a staff writer for the Atlantic Wire. In her media wrap-up, she writes, quote, "The saddest part of it all is that Daisy's fabrications have undermined the entire cause. Being on the side of a good cause does not excuse Daisy's actions. And luckily for the cause of the workers, there are other reporters dedicated to the truth." Hi, Rebecca. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks for joining us. And we're also joined by Andy Kroll. He is a reporter in Mother Jones, Washington, D.C. Bureau. His latest piece is "Are Walmart's Chinese Factories as Bad as Apple's?" Our fiction-free investigation finds that in many cases, the company's auditors are asleep on the job. Hi, Andy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So before we play the clip, Rebecca, you put together a really great piece looking at a lot of media coverage, and it was amazing to watch. Within hours of Ira Glass announcing the retraction, it got coverage almost everywhere, The Guardian, you name it. So what was your overall assessment of how the media covered the retraction?
I think they were trying to, you know, show that journalism is still a noble cause and, you know, show that Mike Daisy wasn't a journalist and why, you know, stand up for This American Life and stand up for journalism and also stand up for the other journalists who were reporting for this cause, you know, in an effort to kind of save the truth and save the facts so that, you know, Mike Daisy's scandal and fabrications didn't become the centerpiece of the story and, you know, really look to what's going on and, you know, how Daisy duped everyone. I mean, we all felt really duped, myself included.
Right. Well, right. We had him on back in February. And Andy, what about you? What really struck you about the coverage of the retraction?
Well, I think that the coverage was, I think, you know, it struck a good balance, you know, as Rebecca said, of, you know, it gave credit to This American Life for devoting an entire episode to it and really doing you know, almost a piece of investigative journalism into a prior This American Life piece of what we thought was investigative journalism, which turned out to be mostly fictional theater. I think that for the most part it was good. I do think that some folks raised good questions about past episodes of This American Life that have come under question for their veracity as well. I know there's been questions about David Sedaris's monologues of the past, sort of his more memoir-type material. John Cook at Gawker wrote a pretty critical piece about that. But for the most part, you know, I think that the coverage was good, and it was right to, you know, give credit to Ira Glass for, you know, creating a masterpiece, you know, of a retraction.
Well, let's hear a clip. So this is from The Retraction, and this is Ira Glass talking to Mike Daisy about the claims he made about hexane and specifically what Mike Daisy's translator said.
Were you afraid that we would discover something if we talked to her?
No, not really.
Really? There was no part of you which thought, like, okay, well, the hexane thing didn't really happen when I was there. And did you feel like there was something that we would discover by talking to her?
Well, I did think you would unpack the complexities of like, how the story gets told.
What does that mean, unpack the complexities?
Well, it means that, you know, just like the hexane thing. I mean, I think I'm agreeing with you.
I mean, with the hexane, we approached you and asked you specifically about that. There's an email that Brian sent you about the hexane. He wrote, Apple's 2011 report, this is their responsibility report, acknowledges the hexane problem at two plants, one at Wintec and another at a logo supplier, but not at Foxconn. These workers you were talking to in the monologue, were they from Foxconn, do you remember, or from other plants? And at that point, you could have come back to us and said, oh, no, I didn't meet these workers. You know, this is just something that I inserted in the monologue based on things I had read and things I had heard in Hong Kong. But instead, you lied further and you said, you wrote, the workers were from Wintec, not Foxconn. Why not just tell us what really happened at that point?
I think I was terrified.
And that is a clip from the This American Life retraction of the Mike Daisy monologue. Rebecca, I have to say it was really hard to hear this segment in some cases, especially these long pauses. And I've heard other people say they were just sort of waiting, like, what is he going to say? And what did you think about the way Ira Glass dealt with this and the questions that he asked?
Yeah, I agree that it was quite painful to listen to the pauses. And I think that Ira handled it very well. You know, you're listening to it and he feels betrayed. And he's also trying to, you know, recover some of the face that he lost by, you know, playing his most popular show being a complete farce. And I think, you know, he does a good job, you know, kind of interrogating Mike Daisy without losing his cool. And I thought that was, you know, pretty incredible.
Yeah, I agree with you. His voice never wavered. He didn't sound irritated. It was, and he, in some parts, he actually expressed sort of sadness for Mike Daisy. What did you think, Andy?
I think Ira did a superb job of asking tough questions of Mike Daisy, and you know, he does a good job of the follow up. In his interview with him in this retraction episode, which, you know, the follow-up question any basic journalism professor will teach you is crucial. You know, the thing about Ira, though, is the retraction episode does make them look more like sort of the victim here, and, you know, they were sort of duped by Mike Daisy. But, you know, as someone who works for a publication that really stresses the importance of fact-checking and rigorous fact-checking, you know, I don't want people to lose track of the fact that This American Life, when they ran the episode in January, really stressed to listeners that this was thoroughly fact-checked, right, and was vetted, but they went to as many lengths as they could to make sure that what Mike Daisy was telling us in this incredibly powerful and well-written monologue was true. And, you know, I think one thing that gets overlooked in the retraction episode is that, you know, This American Life, frankly, did a crappy job fact-checking it. I mean, they missed obvious. I mean, I guess Ira admits it when he says when we didn't reach out to the translator or have notes. You know, Mike Daisy took no notes on this trip from which he wrote this monologue. And Ira does say maybe we should have killed the story there. But, you know, I don't want your listeners to think that This American Life was just the unwitting victim here. I mean, they deserve blame, too, for, you know, falling down on the job and making sure that the original broadcast was accurate.
And didn't Mike Daisy tell Ira Glass that the translator's phone was no longer working, so she wasn't reachable?
Yeah, which is, he did. I think he at first said that he gave a different name.
Right.
In the monologue, he says the translator is Kathy. And then he told Ira, oh, no, it's actually Anna. Oh, and by the way, the cell phone I have for her doesn't work, you know, which obviously suggests that, hey, no one in China has email, even though everyone in China has email. So there, I mean, if it had been a, if This American Life fact-checking process had been as thorough as they claimed it would have, that would have been a huge problem. I mean, not even having notes from Mike Daisy. I mean, that's where you're really taking a big risk. And just confirming that some events happened and then using, you know, you're looking at other reports and saying, well, if child labor has happened in China, well, then what Mike Daisy experienced personally, I guess that checks out. I mean, that's not fact-checking at all. That's Googling.
And again, Ira Glass in the original piece said we've actually spent a few weeks checking everything that he says in the show, and Apple and Foxconn refused the interview request at the time. And today we are talking about media coverage of the This American Life retraction of Mike Daisy's monologue about Foxconn and Apple. What was your reaction to this? It got so much attention, international headlines, just hours after Ira Glass made the announcement. What really stood out for you? And what do you think this says about the facts and the truth in the media? Because Mike Daisy spoke for the very first time at Georgetown, I believe it was last night or the night before. And he basically said that the essential idea is true. And then after this happened, a guest in the audience said, he had me thinking about what's more important, the facts or the truth. So what does this say moving forward? And I'd love to ask our guests what this says about fact and truth, and also how will reporters handle this going forward, especially those who try to go undercover at Foxconn. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And what do you think this does to the work done by labor activists and groups like the China Labor Watch? We had them on with Mike Daisy in February. 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Rebecca Greenfield is a staff writer for the Atlantic Wire, and Andy Kroll is a reporter in Mother Jones, Washington, D.C. Bureau. So let's talk about the facts, because Rob Schmitz in his Marketplace piece says, again, what makes this a little complicated is that the things Daisy lied about seeing are things that have actually happened in China. And the group Students and Scholars Against Corporate Misbehavior put out a release right after this happened, and it's called Apple and Foxconn Are Lying and Calling the Kettle Black. They say that Foxconn spokesperson Louis Wu said, quote, I'm happy that the truth prevails. I'm glad Mike Daisy's lies were exposed. Students and Scholars Against Corporate Misbehavior said they're disturbed by this because they've been monitoring the working conditions at Apple suppliers in China since 2008, and they've got 5 investigative reports on unethical labor practices in 4 different cities. So, Rebecca, what do the facts actually tell us about what goes on in this factory?
Well, yeah, I think it's, I mean, important to note that a lot of the things were true, but I think his lying undermined everything. And I think that it's more important to look at the type of reporting, like at the New York Times and from these labor organizations that show, you know, what is actually going on. And, you know, Mike Daisy was there in 2010, and it's now 2012. And how has Foxconn changed, and how does Foxconn look compared to everybody else? I think the facts and the truth are, I mean, he just, you know, tried to make his story more dramatic by saying he saw it, and that, you know, it's for his own ego building purposes, I don't think. But I do think it is important to note that what is really going on, and, you know, not everything he said was true, but it's not all completely lies, and it's more complex than that. It's, you know, real life is more complex than Foxconn is just this evil, horrible place.
What are your thoughts on this, Andy, in terms of what the facts actually tell us? Because you've got China Labor Watch, you've got Students and Scholars Against Corporate Misbehavior putting out a number of reports about what they've seen.
It makes their lives more difficult. You know, in terms of China Labor Watch and SACOM, as it's known, you know, they often use undercover report, not necessarily reporters, but investigators who will work at, not only at Foxconn, but who will work at, you know, a toy supplier working for Walmart, or they'll work at a shoe company producing shoes for Nike. And these people go to great risks to get jobs at these suppliers and stay there and experience firsthand working conditions and environmental conditions at these places. And then they, you know, the multiple inside experiences form the basis of the reports. And, you know, their job becomes more difficult because you have suppliers now more on guard. You have big companies like Foxconn more aware of people out there and trying to find these things. And, you know, you also just have people becoming more skeptical about someone going to Foxconn and reporting on these kinds of things. You know, in terms of the facts, you know, as someone who's been to China and reported on these things, you know, that Mike Daisy, you know, he has great details in his stories. Unfortunately, these lobbyist details turned out to be true. But if you're looking for hard facts and good investigative reporting, you don't need to resort to these kinds of fabrications. You just have to be willing to put in the work and talk to enough people and be patient about it and just be there and be there on the ground. I mean, we look at reporters like Evan Osnos for The New Yorker, Rob Schmitz for Marketplace, James Fallows for The Atlantic. You know, they wrote stories that are just as colorful and just as compelling as Mike Daisy's work, and they did it just by old-fashioned reporting.
We did a piece about this in 2010, but what's amazing about Mike Daisy is while all of those reports are great global posts, I mean, so many out there, it took a monologist, is that how you say it? Monologist, thank you, to really get this on the radar. And now so many people are talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, it did. And, you know, for better or worse, Mike Daisy made you care.
Right.
He tugged at the heartstrings without a doubt. You know, I think it was beneficial that the New York Times' iEconomy series, especially that, you know, scintillating report on the iPod factory, dropped at the same time because there was actually some factual reporting out there hitting this wave. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lesson for reporters who are doing this work that you've got to really sharpen your storytelling skills. Maybe you've got to find new and more compelling ways in addition to just the written word to tell these stories. I mean, if Mike Daisy has taught us anything, it's that you've got to not only have the hard facts behind it, but you've really got to craft it and put it in a way that works.
Well, we've got a number of callers on this, and then we do want to definitely talk about your Walmart piece. So let's hear from Ben in Berkeley. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I saw Mike Daisy's show at the Berkeley Rep when he performed it there, The Ecstasy and Agony of Steve Jobs, and it was very compelling. And I've heard Mike Daisy's explanation since this thing broke with This American Life, and when he says that what he's going for is a kind of deeper truth or a compelling portrait of the conditions that he found in China, but that he acknowledges that he has given himself the leeway to change some facts and stuff like that. I have to say that I feel manipulated by it, mm-hmm. and I think that I understand his concept, but I think that when people are sitting in the auditorium and Mike Daisy, as a kind of master storyteller, is weaving his tale and drawing people in, there's really the effect of it is that you really do feel like he is telling the truth. And that's an essential part of the effect that his presentation has.
Right. And let me ask you, Ben, so from here on out, when you read articles about Foxconn and the tech companies that use Foxconn, will your opinion about it, will you be more skeptical? What are your thoughts on that?
No, I don't think I'm going to be more skeptical about articles that I see because I do accept Mike Daisy's contention that the story that he was presenting is largely and broadly within the realm of truth. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like it's pretty clear if he said once he acknowledges that he changed some of the facts, that it becomes pretty clear that that a person with his talents could use those abilities to convince large numbers of people of some almost completely fabricated story.
Right.
I think it's very important that he be held responsible for the lies that he told.
Well, thank you for the call, Ben. And so, Andy, what does this mean now for reporters like you moving forward? In your Walmart piece, your tagline was, "Our fiction-free investigation finds that in many cases, Walmart's auditors are asleep on the job." How does this affect your reporting going forward?
I mean, personally, it doesn't. I mean, other than, you know, dropping in that fiction-free sort of wink and nod into the deck of the piece, I mean, I think the caller had it right. Ben had it right, saying, you know, when you go to a news organization, you come in with the assumption that what you're reading has been, you know, reported by someone who knows what they're doing, and it's been fact checked, and it is the facts and nothing else, ma'am. You know, where we get into the gray areas are when you have a something like the agony ecstasy of Steve Jobs, Mike Daisy's one man show. It gets really fuzzy there because on the one hand, he is telling the story from the perspective of someone who experienced it. On the other hand, he says theater, you know, you have a dramatic license in theater. It is drama and you can take liberties with the truth. And so, I mean, I think this whole affair will maybe make folks question the veracity of, say, Mike Daisy's future shows or similar monologues like that. But I mean, for reporters, I don't think it changes anything because, you know, we're going to keep doing what we've always been doing.
Do you agree with that, Rebecca?
I do agree. I mean, even Ben, the caller, was saying that, you know, he isn't really, you know, going to read a New York Times article and wonder if they're telling the truth. I think maybe, and as Andy was saying before, some This American Life monologues might, you know, you might have to take with some dramatic license. But I think that, you know, people hopefully can trust journalism and reporting to report the facts and be fact-checked. And then going forward, that's how it should stay and be.
So, Andy, just briefly, I wanted to talk about your reporting. It's a lengthy piece, "Are Walmart's Chinese Factories as Bad as Apple's?" You report that every second, 330 people buy something from one of Walmart's 8,970 stores worldwide. With 2.1 million workers, it's the world's largest private employer. So what did you find on your lengthy investigation that took you from Arkansas to China?
Well, I found that this much-hyped, quote-unquote, sustainability program, this sort of far-reaching, you know, boardroom-to-breakroom initiative at Walmart to become this sort of green leader, unfortunately, while it is the rhetoric is very high-flying and very impressive, the results on the ground are, you know, fall far short from meeting the goals. And that is especially true in China, where so much of, you know, as much as 70% of the stuff that Walmart sells is produced in that, and, you know, so much of their carbon footprint, you know, their impact, their environmental impact is in China, this manufacturing hub. And you know, I went there and talked to the folks who are spearheading their efforts on the ground there to make their suppliers more energy efficient, to reduce the waste, you know, the carbon emissions, the pollution going into the rivers and the water sources. And unfortunately, they've fallen far short on this, and the momentum has sort of drained away from this program that, here in the U.S., you know, there's lots of shiny press releases and events, and they have a new blog, but the results and the actual action behind this program leave quite a lot to be desired, and that's, you know, nowhere is that more clear than in China.
And we have a number of comments on our website. Dorothy writes, as several of your callers have said, the problem is much bigger than Foxconn and Apple, but includes HP, IBM, and several other large corporations like a Walmart. And what are your thoughts on this, Andy? I mean, she makes a really good point here. Apple has gotten so much attention because it has physical stores and is sitting on $100 billion in cash. But, I mean, even 2020 recently ran a segment about Tommy Hilfiger factories in which people died from a fire. And there are various labor organizations that put out releases on a regular basis about how workers are treated all over the world, Bangladesh, Vietnam, you name it.
Yeah, it's funny that
Apple has become the center of the storm on these, you know, labor issues in China. When, you know, when I talk to manufacturing and energy experts over there, you know, they say, one, Apple is actually one of the most transparent, and, you know, are getting to be one of the most transparent corporations in the world about its supply chain and its suppliers. And also that Foxconn is really near the top in terms of labor conditions and wages and how they treat their workers in China. I know this is hard to wrap your head around when you think about explosions and, you know, exposure to dangerous chemicals and around-the-clock working hours, but this is the reality there. I mean, so much of the manufacturing world in China is murky and shadowy, and it's nothing like a Foxconn. And, you know, and this applies not just to electronics companies or to huge, massive retailers like Walmart, but it applies to, you know, clothing companies. It applies to toy companies. Right. Cosmetics, you know, it is anything you can possibly imagine that you can buy at a store or buy in a catalog, you know, either has a manufacturing base in China where the conditions are most likely quite poor, where the environmental regulations are most likely non-existent. And in certain parts of China, for instance, in the southern part that I went to, you know, since it's been a manufacturing hub for so long, you know, the regulations are starting to catch up. But what we're seeing is either companies fleeing toward more the interior in the country where those regulations don't exist, or they're going to Vietnam, or they're going to Bangladesh, or they're going to Indonesia. They're always in search of the fewest regulations and the cheapest labor. And this is the real story and sort of the bleak reality of it.
Right. And we're actually going to be doing a show about that in just a couple of weeks. That's Andy Kroll, Mother Jones, reporter in the Washington, D.C. Bureau. Be sure to check his Walmart piece. We have a link at yourcallradio.org. We've also linked to Rebecca Greenfield's work. She's a staff writer with the Atlantic Wire. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for your phone calls and emails. Sorry we didn't get to all of you. We will definitely revisit this issue soon. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on Monday. How can arts and culture bring Americans and Iranians closer together? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the Oscar-winning Iranian film, A Separation. During his acceptance speech, the film's director, Asghar Farhadi, urged the world to understand Iran through its rich cultural heritage and history. So what do we really know about Iran? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. How has A Separation changed the conversation about Iranian society? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar. And you.
Next time on Work with Marty Nemko, I invited KALW listeners who've had a career with lots of embedded lessons for all of us to contact me if they'd like to appear on the show. This Sunday, it'll be Brian Jones. He's an accidental entrepreneur who's had to face quite a few personal challenges. Plus, you can call in for a three-minute workover on Work with Marty Nemko, Sunday at 11. That's Sundays from 11 to noon here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Your local public radio station. Coming up next from the BBC World Service, it's World Have Your Say. Then it's the Tavis Smiley Show at noon, followed by Smiley and West. And today it's just Cornel West at 1 o'clock. And at 2 o'clock from the BBC World Service again, it's NewsHour. Stay tuned to your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco, on the web, kalw.org. It's 11 o'clock.
This is the BBC's World Have Your Say. I'm Ben James, and on today's programme, you're going to interview an Iranian ambassador.
Why is Iran harping on about fairness when Iran is not being at all transparent on the issue of nuclear development?
That's one of your questions to Ali Asghar Soltanei, who's Iran's top diplomat at the International Atomic Energy Agency. He's going to be live from Vienna to speak to you. Iran and its nuclear potential has been at the centre of many of your conversations recently. You can post what you want to ask at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. Also, Pakistani cricketer Mohammad Amir was briefly jailed and also banned from the game for 5 years for corruption. Other top players disagree over whether he should ever be able to play again. What do you think? Can sport reporting cheats be forgiven? You can tweet us with the hashtag WHYS.